Welcome to Indie Radio Garden, this week's highlights from community radio in the Philadelphia region.
This program brings ordinary citizens to the air to discuss issues related to health, race, safety, workers' rights, and the will to survive in pandemic times.
Our first segment is from the show Jubilee Voices at WPEB 88.1 Scribe Radio. The hosts, Aya, Sheena, Kevin, Kennelin, and Kennedy, they are 9 and 10 years old, interview the journalist Lynn Washington about the experience of being a Black journalist in Philadelphia.
So I have some questions for Lynn Washington Jr. So my first question is, when did you start writing?
Hi, Kennedy. I started writing really when I was around your age and in your grade. I found out that writing was one of the few things that I could do. I wasn't good at playing basketball. I couldn't dance. And I still can't dance. I couldn't play an instrument, but I could write. I wanted to be, at some point in my life, a novelist, and I wanted to have a sailboat and float around the Caribbean and write novels. I never really wanted to be a newspaper reporter. The only newspaper reporter I knew when I was young was a guy named Clark Kent, and he was Superman. So being a reporter was incidental to being Superman. But after I graduated from college and I was looking for a job, the only job that I could get was as a newspaper reporter, and I found out that I really, really, really liked it. So I've been a writer basically all my life, but I only became a newspaper reporter after I graduated from college.
Okay, thank you. Next question was, why did you want to write for the book press?
I have always had a like for and a commitment to institutions that serve the African-American community. I have to admit that when I started working for the Black Press, I started out working for the Philadelphia Tribune, and I did some freelance writing for other Black institutions, like some things that were a part of the Ebony Jet Company out of Chicago. It was only after I started working for the Tribune that I really started understanding and learning more about the history of the Black Press. The reality, though, is this. I was freelancing for the Philadelphia Tribune. I needed a full-time job. I had a child at the time. My wife said, you know, I appreciate your dreams, but we need some money for diapers and milk and rent. So I just started working for the Tribune. That was the only place that would hire me. We're talking about the mid-1970s, but the Inquirer, the other newspapers, the TV stations, the radio stations that did news in the city of Philadelphia, they still practice then, as well as today to a certain degrees, but they were practiced a lot of prejudice. They were not hiring persons of color. And the Tribune gave me that opportunity, and I tried to take the best of it. And, you know, not only fell in love with journalism, but fell in love with the institution of the Black Press, knowing what it can do. And along the way, I found out that the Black Press has a very interesting history here in Philadelphia. While the Philadelphia Tribune is the oldest continuously publishing news, Black-owned newspaper in the country, that means that from the time it started publishing in 1883, it is published every week since then. Actually, the oldest Black-owned newspaper in the United States is an entity called the Christian Recorder. And that's the newspaper for the AME Church, which was founded here in Philadelphia. They started publishing in 1852, but they didn't publish for a couple of months here and there and a few years here and there. So that's why they're not recognized as the oldest continuously publishing. And one of the things that has just really surprised me, and I think it says a lot about where the media is and where it's been, today, we have concerns about unfairness and prejudice in news coverage. Well, in 1794, two Black Philadelphians published a pamphlet where they attacked inaccurate and racist coverage by another publisher. So the first effort by African-Americans in the United States to address the issue of bigoted coverage in the news media took place here in Philadelphia in 1794.
Oh, wow. Thank you. There's some things I really didn't know about the Philadelphia Tribune.
Okay. And I guess I should say, I know I'm a little older than you guys, but in 1883 and 1794, I wasn't around. Okay.
Yeah.
I'm not that old.
Okay. Thank you. Next question. What are the type of articles were posted in the Philadelphia Tribune?
Well, when you look at the Philadelphia Tribune throughout its history, you see that there is a concern for improvements in the Black community, not only improvements in terms of lessening the discrimination that the Black Philadelphians have faced, but also efforts within the community to take care of issues. We talk about, for example, the level of violence that we see today. Well, when you look at the Tribune over the decades, you see concerns raised about the level of violence in the Black community. Today, as people say, well, why are all Black people Democrats? And then you hear the Republicans saying, well, the Democratic Party treats Blacks like slaves. Well, coming out of the Civil War, most Blacks were members of the Republican Party because the Republican Party at that time was pushing for fairness. And I have in my files here at home where, you know, I collect a lot of history and things. I have an article from 1934 where a number of prominent Blacks in the city, I'm talking about people who were lawyers who later became judges and became members of Congress and successful business people, they wrote an article that was critical of the Republican Party, saying that African Americans had been loyal to the Republican Party, given the Republican Party their votes, and they got nothing out of it. No jobs, no housing, no education. So when we look at the Philadelphia Tribune and look at it over time, we really see the history of Black Philadelphia written on the pages of the Philadelphia Tribune. So one of the interesting ways to learn more about Black Philadelphia and the real story that you don't usually get in history books, you have to read the Philadelphia Tribune. There's a really interesting book about Black Philadelphia called Up South, and the author is a guy named Matthew Countryman. And he took a look at Philadelphia, I guess from like the 30s up to like the 70s. And when you read a lot of these scholarly books, you see footnotes where the author lets you see where he gets the information from or where she gets the information from. And many of the footnotes reference articles in the Philadelphia Tribune.
Thank you. You just answered my question, because I've always wondered why most of the African-American, well, some of the African-American community wasn't Democrats. Right. But thank you. So my last question is, how did your writing in the Tribune help the African-American community?
I let me put it this way. I hope that I made a contribution. I hope that in my writing and my efforts to not only accurately report on things that were happening, but also to try to show the context of what things are happening, I hope that that had an impact. But I would just give you one example of what I think would be an impact of my writing. In 1977, I received an award for writing, and it was by a Black community organization, and they were recognizing a couple of journalists in the city who they said were doing good jobs in terms of providing information and news to the Black community. One of the persons that won an award on that program was a guy named Mumia Abu-Jamal. So when you hear these criticisms that, well, there's no evidence that Mumia never won any awards, he did win awards. The first award he won on that program that I was one of the recipients of also. And we got those awards because of our reporting that people in the Black community recognized as being helpful to the overall empowerment of the Black community.
Thank you. That was all of my questions.
Okay, Kennedy. Thank you.
What journalists do you look up to most, and what is your reason?
I could keep it short and sweet on that one. One of the people that I admire as a journalist is a person that we're talking about who unfortunately can't be here to talk for himself, and that's Mumia. When I think that Mumia has written more essays and commentaries than just about any journalist on earth. And he wrote those things from a cell, first a death row cell, and now just a regular prison cell. And he literally writes it. And I mean, in terms of writing longhand, because the prison won't give him or won't have let him have access to a typewriter or a laptop computer to write. When I think also that here's a man who was in death row isolation for 30 years and has now been in prison for an additional 10 years, who has written over 15 books, that's extraordinary. And it's really inspirational. But as Ms. Wadia was saying, it's bittersweet. It's great to see this level of production, but it's bitter to think of where that production is taking place and why that writer should not be there.
The second piece is from WJYNLP 98.5, Uptown Entertainment and Development. E. Marie Lambert interviews
Carol Mortarati,
certified life coach, grief and loss recovery expert, on the Talk to Reeves show about grief and loss recovery management.
My guest, Miss Carol Mortarati, with us this evening. And again, she is a life coach and grief recovery expert. Hi, so nice to see you face to face.
Thank you, Emarie. It's so wonderful being here. And I love that you're holding this series because grief seems to be like a taboo topic and it needs, you know, it needs to be discussed. People need to have these conversations in order to heal. So the more we talk about it, the more exposure it gets. And, you know, it's a collective healing. So thank you for having me as a guest, and thank you to your listeners that are listening live and also on the replay.
Carol, tell us a little about your journey and how you came to be a grief coach.
Yes, it was a journey I never expected to take, but unexpectedly, my ex-husband died by suicide in 2011, and my world was completely turned upside down, as well as my son's. And I really didn't have any warning. I really didn't. There's no guidebook on how to heal or recover. So after about a year of just living in a fog, I got really tired of waking up feeling depressed and sad and hopeless. So I started reaching out and I found training. I hired a life coach and I started implementing different tools into my lifestyle to start my healing journey and start feeling a little bit lighter each day and a little bit more hopeful that I can recover. And ultimately, you know, this is 9 years now, and I feel like we're always healing further and deeper. So it's not like a cold where once you've grieved and you've healed, it's out of your system. You know, you'll always have tough days, but now I'm in a different place and I'm so thankful to be feeling so much freer and lighter and really going after my hopes and dreams again, that I felt obligated to get certified as a grief coach and go on to help others, because there are sadly so many people in need of healing after loss. And I felt obligated to really, I feel honored to help others heal.
Grief and grieving are so personal and so intimate. And I love that you said that you did the work, that you went and you got a grief coach yourself, a life coach, and then you took some workshops and some trainings and some classes so that you're able to help other people. You're a person who went through it. You know what it feels like. You felt it, you know, dealt with it, and you live with it. Because like you said, there's no end to grieving. You just learn to manage and cope and live through it. And I love that you're doing that. So what are some of the things or some of the tools that you give people when they come to you?
Well, a lot of times since we're talking about loss of a spouse or significant other, there may be things that they want to say to them that they didn't get a chance to say. So I love journaling. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really very therapeutic. And I love writing a goodbye letter.
Okay. Wow.
I love writing a goodbye letter, and then when you're done with it, not rereading it, not ripping it up, but going outside or in a safe place, but burning the letter. Because what that does, is it's just a releasement of letting go of all the things you've been holding on to. You know, maybe there's some anger or unresolved issues in the relationship, or you feel guilty. I mean, a lot of times you feel guilty when you write that goodbye letter and then you burn it. All the negativity gets released into the universe. And then once you've completed that, you need to replace that negativity that you've released with some positive affirmations, you know, so it's complete. But I find that journaling is very therapeutic. One thing that helped me was also gratitude. And a lot of my clients are, sometimes they get upset at first because they're like, Carol, I'm in the darkest moments of my life. What could I possibly have to be grateful for? And there's always something. When I wake up, even still to this day, I think of three things that I'm grateful for.
Wow.
And it takes 30 seconds. I do it before I get out of bed because it really sets the tone for the entire day. And I also, it shifts your energy too. And I also look for things throughout the day, like of other things that I can be grateful for. You know, when you're practicing gratitude and you're having that, you're projecting that energy, sometimes you go to buy a cup of coffee and, you know, the salesperson accidentally gives you a large instead of a small. And it's like they can feel that energy and they can feel like, you know, that you're coming from a loving place. And so things start opening up. And it's really important because you want to shift that energy from like being a victim to being not only a survivor, but a thriver, because it is possible to heal from loss and go on and live an amazing life. As you said, like it does take work, but I mean, what kind of a life do you want to live? Do you want to live one as a victim and really have a lot of regrets at the end of your life? Or do you want to honor the person that you've lost and really they would want you to live your best life? So by honoring them and living your best life, you know, it's a win-win for you. And it's also a win for honoring your lost one.
On our Northwest check-in, WGGTLP 92.9 G-Town radio host Joanna Wykander interviews Rachel Marcus, pediatric nurse, about the COVID-19 vaccine and a recent COVID-19 teen vaccination clinic she coordinated at Green Street Friends in collaboration with Pelham Pharmacy.
Welcome our guest, Rachel Marcus, to the Northwest Check-In, the Mount Airy neighbor, a mother of two, a pediatric nurse, and she's been actively working on getting our neighbors vaccinated against COVID-19. So recently, in collaboration with Pelham Pharmacy, she hosted a teen COVID-19 vaccination clinic at Green Street Friends School. Can you tell me a little about the teen vaccination clinic you coordinated a few weeks ago?
Thanks so much, Joanna. Yeah, so when the FDA had given approval for teenagers aged 12 to 15 to be vaccinated, we wanted to get on that quickly. So we hosted a clinic with the help of Green Street Friends School and invited all of the neighborhood schools, Chestnut Hill, Mount Airy, Germantown, and ended up getting about 540 children and two adults vaccinated over two clinics that weekend.
That's amazing. That's a fantastic number.
Yeah, we were very, very excited.
I invited Rachel to talk about the COVID-19 vaccine. So let's start with who's eligible to get vaccinated.
So right now, anybody ages 12 and over is eligible to get vaccinated.
And so why is it so important that everyone who is eligible get the vaccine?
COVID-19 is a very sort of sneaky disease. And that, as we've all heard, it's really taken a huge toll on the elders in our population, with a much increased risk of hospitalization, organ damage, and death in those, you know, 60 or 65 and over. The other thing, though, is that it has been causing severe illness and death in younger people, too. And there sometimes is just not a whole lot of rhyme or reason to that. So people who have been generally healthy and are young and, you know, all of those things that we sort of think about as like good indicators of health have really been taken down as well. And now, as we're sort of coming into this second year of the pandemic, a few different things are happening. So one thing that's happening is that the variants have come in and they're causing higher rates of transmission. In some cases, they may be causing higher rates of hospitalization, but also people who have immunity from previous COVID infection may not be able to fight off those infections of the variants. And we are seeing some cases of people getting COVID a second time and sometimes getting very, very ill and even dying from it. With vaccination, we are able to protect the community, protect ourselves, and also protect those around us from getting COVID, from ending up sometimes permanently disabled or dead.
So also too, as we talk about like vaccine and getting everyone vaccinated, we keep hearing the phrase herd immunity. So what is herd immunity? Because we have those in our population under the age of 12 that can't get vaccinated yet.
So herd immunity in this case is a little bit complicated because there's questions about whether or not we will reach true herd immunity, being the point where there is no longer any COVID in our community because of vaccination. But what we can see, even without true herd immunity, is sort of this population immunity approaching herd immunity. So basically what that means is that the more people who get vaccinated means that there's fewer people who can catch COVID. The fewer people who catch COVID mean the fewer people who are out there to spread COVID. We think this group just kind of shrinks smaller and smaller and smaller, because if there's nobody to transmit within a community, even people who are unable to get vaccinated or are unable to mount an immune response, say that they are a transplant recipient, there's nobody in that community then to transmit COVID to them, which protects them. We sort of like think about the herd as the community.
So then this kind of comes to my next question. My husband and I, we're both vaccinated. We're now going out and seeing other adults that are vaccinated, but we have children that are ours and our friends. So we're still having them wear masks. But is it safe for us to hang out with vaccinated adults and then come home? What is our likelihood of transmitting the virus back to our children?
So I can't give numbers because they don't exist yet. Based on studies that I have seen, your risk of contracting COVID, even if you have no symptoms, is decreased about 90%. So that means that for every 10 people who are not vaccinated, your risk is 1/10 that of those who are not vaccinated. What we don't quite understand at this point is how likely, if you are to have what we call a breakthrough infection after vaccination, how likely you are to transmit it. What we do know is the viral load of those who have breakthrough infections after vaccination, and that number of breakthrough infections is very small. The viral load is lower. And what that should mean is that it is less likely for even those who are carrying COVID to transmit COVID. Based on what the CDC is saying, as a vaccinated person, you are safe to hang out with other vaccinated people and then go home to your children. So if you think about the probability of those vaccinated people having COVID, right, that's much decreased. Then if one were to have it, the probability of you getting it as a vaccinated person then is decreased. And then the probability of you having it as a breakthrough and being able to transmit it to somebody is then further, right, decreased. So really the odds are very low.
It's really important for our community to get vaccinated. People are hesitant to get their teenagers vaccinated, and there is this fear that it can cause infertility.
So this I've heard as well, and I've done a little bit of research on, because again, there's nothing in the vaccines that no good scientific way that that's possible. So it appears that this fear, this myth, came from a scientist in Germany who, when looking at this piece of genetic code, right, this RNA that's in the vaccine, said, oh, it looks a little bit similar to a protein that allows the placenta to attach to the uterus. And I wonder if by making antibodies against this part of the protein of the COVID-19 virus, it would make a placenta no longer or less likely to implant, right? This literally was something off the top of his head that he put out into the universe. Number one, this RNA is not that similar to this protein on a placenta, A. B, that's not really how it works. You know, when you have a placenta, right, your body sees that as its own, not as a foreign entity. And most important, ultimately, this was studied and it's just not true. So this kind of very specific concern, which turned out to be a complete fallacy, completely untrue.
Thank you for answering that one. And as we talk about vaccines and, you know, we still have our kids under the age of 12 who can't get vaccinated yet, I've been reading that there's tests currently going on and there is speculation that children under the age of 12 might be able to get vaccinated as soon as the fall. Do you have any information on that?
What I know is the same as what has been in the media, which is that Pfizer has come out and said that they believe that they will be applying for FDA approval as early as September. And Moderna then came out and said, us too. So we are hoping, you know, all of us, we know that the trials are in progress right now. Some of them are fully enrolled and they're just watching. We're hoping that that's going to be the case, that they're going to get good information and we'll be able to get our kids vaccinated early on in the school year.
And we're both mothers of children under the age of 12.
Yes.
And I'm going to say this, if it becomes available, I will get my daughter vaccinated. Will you?
I would say I'm going to be waiting in line at midnight like it's a Mick Jagger concert in 1981. I believe in the safety of these vaccines. I believe in it for myself. I believe in it for my kids. If I could vaccinate them tomorrow, I would. I know that these vaccines have saved a lot of lives already. And the more people that get vaccinated, the more lives and livelihoods we can save.
Yeah, it's been a wild school year for our kids. And when I was talking to my daughter about the vaccine, and she said, I want people to get vaccinated so that I can go to school and see my friends without masks. And that really touched my heart.
Right. I mean, one of the most powerful things for me about the teen clinics were that these kids, these 12, 13-year-olds, who, let me tell you, are not usually the first lined up for shots, were literally crying in relief. You know, these are kids who haven't seen their grandparents in months and months and months, or kids who haven't been able to be in school more than, you know, these couple days a week, if at all. And these kids who just saw this vaccine as the beginning of the way out. And we know that what we need is not just a high enough percentage of people, but we need a high enough percentage of people in every community. Because while we talk about the general herd immunity, say in the country or in the world, we just need that community immunity within smaller communities, because that's who we interact with, is the people outside of our kids' schools, the people, you know, at the stores that we shop in, the people, you know, our neighbors. And so that is the thing that we need.
Can you imagine if there was this kind of hesitancy for vaccines when the polio vaccine was released or when the MMR vaccine was released?
And we see now in communities that are less likely to vaccinate against, say, those diseases, we see people dying of diseases that they don't need to die from. You know, I have seen children die of measles. I have seen children die of whooping cough. I have seen children die of the flu. And many of those children live in communities where either people don't believe in vaccination, whatever that means.
Well, thank you so much, Rachel, for all your good work and great information.
Thanks for joining us. My name is Gladys Nobrega with the Scrap Radio Project. Indie Radio Garden is a Prometheus Radio Project production.